I'm Kathy Sutina, and this is The Efficiency Code, your guide to unlocking peak performance in finance and procurement. Join us as we crack the code to sustainable growth. My guest today is Charlene Bassett. Charlene is an experienced operations leader with deep expertise in product operations and technology. As the Chief Operating Officer at OnDeck Australia, a fintech company, Charlene has been instrumental in driving strategic growth and operational efficiency across multiple business functions. With a career that spans roles at Commonwealth Bank, Deutsche Bank, and JP Morgan, Charlene brings a wealth of experience in financial services, product management, and business transformation. Since joining OnDeck nearly a decade ago, she played a pivotal role in scaling the company's credit operations and technology, helping small businesses thrive with faster, more flexible financing solutions. Welcome to the show, Charlene.
Thank you very much, Kathy. Great to be here.
So great to have you here. But first, let's start with this question. What does sustainable growth mean to you, and how have you applied it as your role on OnDeck's COO?
Yeah, great question. I mean, I think for a lending business, the cash component of sustainability is really important. You know, not only do we need capital for operating expenses, but we also need it for lending out, right? So managing cash is something that we think about all the time and is really, really critical. And it would be the same for any lending business. But I think if we, you know, if we think about the sort of day-to-day key priorities, there's really three as it comes to sustainable growth. The first one is really making sure that we are making profitable lending decisions. So we spend a lot of time making sure that we're lending out to the right people, the right amount of money. And obviously that really changes as the macroeconomic environment changes as well. So it's a very agile process. It's not sort of set and forget. It's something that we spend a lot of time on. The second is really around compliance. Again, as a lending business, making sure that we are compliant with regulation and the sort of legal side of things is really important. You know, again, perhaps more so than sort of consumer-facing businesses that might, you know, sell clothing, etc. This is a really big part of what we do. So that's really important. And then I think the third thing, and this is the one that's probably closest to my heart in my role as the COO, is really investing in our intellectual property, whether that's our credit models, whether that is our technology or our data and analytics environment, to drive the best customer experiences, but also automation. So I think that's a really big part of our journey and our story, but really driving automation for that customer experience, but also to drive operational efficiencies. So that's been something I've been very focused on over the last couple of years. So yeah, they're really sort of the three sort of pillars, I guess, of how we think about sustainable growth.
And it's interesting that you mentioned operations there, because as a fintech company, you have to walk this tightrope between moving fast and staying compliant with all those regulations and trying to get the automation push forward. So I'm really curious about your automation journey. What was your, and if there was an aha moment that made you as an OnDeck decide to focus on automation, and was there a particular challenge that you were trying to solve?
Yeah, great question again. I think the aha moment actually sort of came to us in COVID, which was a very challenging time, as you can imagine, for small business lending and for our small business customers. And I guess we had been very busy focusing on growth and you know, the key priorities prior to that. And COVID forced us to stop. And it gave us a moment to actually think about what we wanted to be doing and to actually sort of take some spare time, if you like, to think about where we would go next. And so we used that COVID time to start this journey that we've been on over the last sort of really 4 or 5 years, looking at automation and how we could really make sure that we had a business that would be profitable at a much smaller book size than, you know, perhaps we'd previously been aiming for, and really looking at automation to help us with that. And again, to deliver on great customer experiences. So we actually kicked off a project in that time. We called it Project Focus. And where we started was really looking at standardizing our decision making and our rules. So, you know, traditionally in lending businesses, you have underwriters, and it's really about how they feel about the deal, how they feel about the customer. They look at the financials. That's the traditional way of doing it. Fintechs had sort of taken the front end experience and taken that online and really automated it. But a lot of what was sitting in the back end in a lot of fintech businesses and is still today is there's still a lot of people involved in that decision making. And we said, no, we want to, we might still need people, but we want to make sure that those people are making the same decisions, that we're really standardizing those decisions so that a customer gets a very standardized experience. It doesn't depend on how the underwriter feels on any given day. So we took everything that we knew, we created all these rules, we put them into our what we call our originations Bible. And essentially we took the guesswork out of it. We took the gray out of it. And we said, our decision making is black or it's white. And that's really, you know, that's how we're going to make decisions. So that was where we started with sort of that project, which was immensely successful. And actually what we were able to create at the back of that was a product that we call the Lightning Loan Experience, which effectively means that we can decision a small business owner in as little as 30 minutes, which is pretty powerful. You know, 5 minutes to apply and maybe 30 minutes to get a decision. That was what we were able to create with that. So that was pretty transformational for us. And then, you know, we've been building on that from there. And I suppose the next stage of the journey for us was really supporting that with technology. So we implemented a new platform, which allowed us to really take all those rules and automate them and deliver them up in a workflow experience for our underwriters that was much faster and allowed us to get great data out of that as well. And then we're now working on the sort of third phase of that project, which is, again, building in the technology, the data and the credit models to make those decisions even faster and really with less gray again, but much, much faster and much better experience for our customer. So it's been an amazing journey, actually, over the last 5 years. And when I sort of look back on it, it's, you know, I think we're pretty proud of what we've done, but we're not finished yet.
And this is such a great example of how automating becomes not just a benefit to the company, because I can just assume that you do not need that much headcount, because now you're automating the underwriters. The underwriters' headcount can be lower than that. Yeah. But also, you're giving the decision to the consumer much, much faster. So now they don't have to wait a couple of days to get the decision. They get it within 30 minutes. And that is absolutely impressive. So how were you able to do that? Were you doing this in-house, or did you work with other tech companies to develop it?
So the first phase of that project we did in-house, and we used the really smart people in our business from across different departments to come together and to figure those rules out and to make those decisions about what we wanted to do going forward. So that was very successful. In terms of the technology, we've taken a bit of a split approach. We outsource where we think it makes sense, mm-hmm. and where we can outsource to really expert providers who we think are the best in the world. And we do look globally for those. And then we insource where we think it's really important for IP protection. So, for example, our credit modeling is insourced. We use people in-house for that, that work on that all of the time. But, you know, conversely, our originations platform is supported by a company in the US who we think are, you know, really excellent at providing this kind of solution. And we tailor it, you know, we work with them to tailor it to our needs. And we do have quite specific needs because of the nature of what we're doing around automation. We're at the front line of that. And so actually we really challenge our partners around that to sort of take it to the bleeding edge of what people are doing. So, it's a bit of a balance. But I think from a cost perspective, That's been really helpful for us. You know, when you're leveraging people that are working, you know, across with multiple businesses, the costs are much, much lower from a, particularly from a technology perspective, than trying to build all that in-house and maintain it in-house. You know, I think, unfortunately, you know, we've seen other fintech companies that have really tried to be all things to all people on the tech front, and they end up with huge cost bases around that. And they end up then having to try and sell that technology to other people to sort of to justify the cost. So we've been quite strategic and quite deliberate in outsourcing where we think it makes sense.
And how do you make those decisions? Is there a strategic meeting that you do with all the CFOs, the CEO, yourself? How do you make those decisions? What are you gonna actually do in-house and what are you going to outsource?
Yeah, I think, like I say, it comes down mostly to that principle of, you know, if we think it's core IP, then it's just naturally in-house. If we think that we don't have that skill set, then we go looking. We've actually recently been working with a company, again, a US-based company, who have an amazing platform that allows you to build out your decisioning engine and self-service it, which is very, very powerful. And again, allows you to host your models on their platform, but manage those yourself. Whereas traditionally, you know, they're built into those technology platforms and you have to go through developers to get things changed. Whereas this platform is very smart in that it allows us to make those changes and allows us to maintain that agility that we really need from a credit model perspective. Again, allows us to react to the macro environment. And so we, you know, we chose those guys as a partner, but we went out and we looked at multiple options. We looked at what it would take for us to do it in-house. And my team delivered a proposal there to the executive team, the CFO, the CEO, and the chief risk officer, saying, you know, this is what we think we should do. So yeah, we're very deliberate about those things. But I think that guiding principle directs us, you know, keeps us pretty honest with that path.
And as you were going through this project, and especially since it's still an ongoing thing, as you said, you're in phase three, has there been anything unexpected or something surprising that happened?
Many, many, many things. Gosh, if I had a dollar for every time something unexpected had happened. I think it's the nature of trying to do really, really big things, right? Really big transformation, but also really big transformation that no one else has done before. You don't always get it right. And we've made mistakes along the way. We sort of look at that as it's part of the course, right? If everybody was doing it, if it was easy, everybody would be doing it. That's really how we look at it. So we make mistakes. It's okay. Things take longer than you expect every time. You know, even when you build in for buffer, things take longer. It's a definite learning experience and a real journey. But I think that the, you know, when you reach a milestone, when you deliver on something for the customers, it keeps everybody going for that next phase. You know, they can see that it's really game changing. We think about the failure as a positive thing, but it's not always easy when you, you know, when you want something and you can see it so close, but you've got to do some more work.
Yeah, it's always harder when you're in the weeds of it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Has there been anything that originally you thought this is going to be a great automation project and we're going to do that, but then when you took a step back, you realized, no, this is probably better if we still keep it as a manual process?
Not necessarily in that way. I think that probably the way that we've thought about that is there are some customers that you can automate the decision for, and then there are others where that just does not work. So to give you an example, a company that has a really complicated company structure that maybe owns multiple businesses or multiple sites, that is very difficult to automate because it doesn't fit the mold. You know, there's those edge cases. Big companies are generally much more difficult to apply these rules to than smaller companies or more simple structures of companies. So that's probably where we, you know, we have the lightning path, which allows us to use those rules and to use the black and white. And we have a non-lightning path that allows us to apply judgment to those deals that don't fit that pathway. And so we still have underwriters that do make judgmental decisions today for those deals. And to give you a sense, it's the minority of our decisions that are made that way. And to give you maybe even more of a sense, we have as many underwriters today in our business as we did 5 years ago. And our business is much, much bigger than it was 5 years ago. So we have been able to really grow, to push more volume through, more applications that we assess without having to hire more underwriters than we had 5 years ago. So for us, that's been a tremendous success. But yet, that you still do need people to apply judgmental thinking in certain cases.
And I think this also goes into the whole idea of the 80-20 rule. And as you have said, originally, when we opened the conversation about what it means to have a sustainable business, we were talking about the profitable business and really understanding the type of customers are the ones that give you the most profit, so you can also put them into the automation streamline versus just having them do by hand, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, we're a company that is very, very data-driven, very data-centric. We don't make decisions about anything in our business without data, whether that be a loan application or whether that be a business case for a strategic project. We're very focused on data. And so for us, that even comes down to the granularity of, so which customers really are profitable, which channels, which industries, where do we want to grow our business to focus on that more profitable segments of customers, and you know, what is the lifetime value of a customer as well. So, you know, a lot of our customers come back to us multiple times for loans over many years, and you know, really thinking about what is the profitability of that customer over that lifespan, rather than necessarily just the first time they might take funds from us. So we get very, very granular into that. You know, and we talk about that. That's a sort of daily, weekly conversation for us, is, you know, really, where are we trying to focus on profitable business, rather than just growth for growth's sake. And I think, you know, in today's environment, everyone's talking about profit. But, you know, a few years back, it was really a lot of people wanted to talk about growth. That's not been our story. We've been very focused on profitability and sustainable growth, to your point, over the long term.
Yeah, that's such a huge thing. And, you know, I've seen it with companies that are chasing growth at all costs. And that's how you get into a lot of high water with the business, because growth just for the growth's sake, it can have such detrimental impact to the financials of the company. It has to be healthy and sustainable.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you're absolutely right. The challenge in a lending business, again, is you don't really know what you should have priced that customer at until you get the money back, right? It's this, you know, if I'm selling you a pair of shoes, I give you the shoes, you give me the money, the transaction's finished, and you might come back and buy another pair of shoes in the future, but it cost me $100 to make the shoes and I sold you for $150. That's it. I know what my margin is. Thanks very much. It's very difficult with loans, right? I say to you, okay, well, I think it should be $150, but I don't really know whether you're going to pay me back, whether you're going to pay me back on time, whether you're going to pay me back the full amount. There's lots of things that are very dynamic in that relationship between us that makes it very difficult to price effectively. And I think if you're going after growth, you can be blind to, well, hang on, I need actually to find the customers that are very profitable and I can be sure are going to give me, you're going to give me my money back. And I think that's very challenging, particularly for fintechs who've, you know, relied on maybe that that growth conversation to achieve the multiples that they're looking for, and attract that the investment that they need, it can lead you to some tricky decision making. So you've got to be aware of that and try not to fall into that trap, which is hard.
Yeah, and you know, the risk is a variable in pricing that you generally do not have in other types of businesses, whether it might be service-based or e-commerce or whatever it might be. But in the fintech, financial services type of businesses, risk is definitely a factor that you have to put in as you're pricing things out.
Yeah. It's what makes it so interesting, though, as a place to work. It's very, very mentally challenging and stimulating, I think, for a lot of people. It's what I think they find, you know, the people that work for us find really exciting about the work they do, is it's not straightforward. It's not, here's the shoes, they cost me $100, let's charge $150. It's really complex stuff. So that's personally what I love about it as well.
It's a giant puzzle to solve.
It is. And it's a moving puzzle.
So if you could go back into your early days with OnDeck, with your current knowledge, if you could transport yourself back into time, what would you tell yourself?
Probably the first thing I'd tell myself is it was going to take a long time to build an awesome business. You know, it doesn't happen overnight. You know, and I know people talk about sort of overnight successes, and then we laugh about seeing that company's been in business for 15 or 20 years. But, you know, the media loves to say things are an overnight success, but actually building an amazing business is hard, and it takes time. I think that you know, you learn a massive amount along the way with that. You do make mistakes, and that's okay. Yeah, I think that's probably the key one for me, is it's just going to take you some time. You're going to learn a lot, but you'll get there. And I think we feel really good about where we are as a business. But it, you know, that's hard fought knowledge, right? That's, again, if it was easy, everyone would be doing it.
Yeah, it doesn't happen overnight.
No.
So as you're focusing on improving the business and doing the automations, and I would call this continuous improvement, how has that shaped your team's culture and experience?
I have to say, you know, it's actually been very, very positive for the culture of the business. And we're very lucky. We've been awarded a lot of great accolades over the last few years externally. So we won the best place to work in Australia last year, and we came second place this year. And that's a pretty amazing award to be given, something we're very proud of. But I think a lot of that success has come from the really audacious goals that we've set for people, and the vision that we have. People are really excited by that. It's a pretty cool thing to be involved with, trying to do something that no one else has really done. And I think that really drives people on. They can really attach themselves to that vision and see the benefit as well of what they're doing. And I think, you know, we're a 90 person company. We don't have thousands of people. And so all the work that people do in the business is really important. And they can see that what they do is driving outcomes. You know, to give you an example, our senior product manager was heavily involved in that project 5 years ago. In a slightly different role, actually. And he created the Lightning Loan, or was part of the team that created the Lightning Loan. And then he named the Lightning Loan. You know, we sort of said, what should we call this? And he said, let's call it the Lightning Loan. And, you know, that's a wonderful thing to be able to say that you made. So it's sort of been a bit unexpected in terms of the cultural impact and positivity this has had. But I think, we, now that we understand that, we want to make sure that we carry that forward, you know, through into years into the future, that we don't lose that excitement and that passion, even when perhaps the goal has been achieved, if it ever really is. So I think, yeah, if you give people a really clear and audacious goal to try and achieve, it's very motivating. especially if you give them the space to go off and do that. Yeah, I think it's very motivating, actually. So yeah, we're very, very fortunate to have a very, very positive culture where people love coming to work.
Is there anything particular that's been helpful when you've been nurturing the culture? Obviously, being open with your goals, having these big, hairy, audacious goals. Anything else that's been super helpful for you as you've been cultivating this culture?
You know, it's not one thing. I think, you know, and perhaps I'd give you an example, but we made a decision in COVID that we wanted people to come back to the office as soon as we were allowed to come back to the office. You know, a lot of companies, I think, really went down a path of, okay, well, we love remote, let's all be remote all the time, and that's great, and everyone will love that, work from home. And we mm-hmm. never did that. We were very clear, and we are very clear, that we work best together in person, and that particularly the younger people that work for us learn so much by being in person together with the more experienced folks. And I think, you know, we came back together 3 days a week in the office very quickly after COVID. And those days in the office are the same for everybody. So it's not a case of just turning up and then doing Zoom calls with everybody else. You know, it's really come in and collaborate and work together yeah. and try and solve these really challenging problems together. And actually recently we've moved back to 4 days in the office because we love it so much. And I think that's just one of the things that's really, again, helped us with that culture. We don't apologize for it. It's such an amazing energy in our office, you know, when people are coming together to solve those things. So I think, you know, that's just one example, but there's so many things that go into building that culture and maintaining it. Recruitment is another one. You know, we are very clear about who we bring into the business and who we don't. We make mm-hmm. sure that we do a cultural interview, often with me or with the head of people and culture or with a member of the team, to make sure that we're bringing people in who are going to help us build it, build that culture and not detract from it. And frankly, if it doesn't always work out right, and you've got to make those difficult decisions as well when it doesn't work. But we're very protective of it. You know, we're very protective of what we've created.
Yeah. I could see why. I mean, if things were working well for you now, like why change it, right? And I want to switch gears with this. We talked a lot about automations and efficiency. And I'm curious, for a company such as yourselves, there's probably quite a couple of SaaS costs, cloud costs that you have to deal with. How do you manage that?
Yeah, we got a lot of SaaS providers, actually. The secret really is getting it together. It's not something that is managed by multiple people in the business that, you know, we don't have oversight of. We made a very concerted effort a few years ago to bring everything together into one place. We actually use Vertice for the vast majority of our SaaS contracts, and we use their portal to manage those contracts, which is very, very helpful. But even outside of those, so some of the biggest sort of niche SaaS providers that we have, everything is centralized, and we really have a clear accountability. Who mm-hmm. owns that relationship? Who owns the contract? When is the contract coming up for renewal? You know, how are we going to, what do we need? What are the levels of service that we might need? Do we need to review the number of licenses? It's a little bit of effort, I have to say, to keep all of that under control. But given the spend with these providers, it is super, super critical. I think the other thing that, particularly on the data front, that team has done really well is they've got some mechanisms in place to really monitor our usage, you know, around certain costs. And that's very helpful in terms of making sure that, you know, you don't blow the budget on things like mm-hmm. that. So we've also put those kind of mechanisms in place to alert us when, you know, the spend is looking like it's going over and above. So we're pretty good at managing all of that. But I have to say, using using technology platforms to support that has been very, very helpful for us. And having clear accountability has also been super helpful.
And you mentioned that you use Retease to manage a lot of this as well. What was the one thing that you have seen that decided that gave you that decision? Like, we need to actually have a vendor for this versus us trying to do it on our own.
Again, it sort of comes back to what we discussed earlier, which is outsource the things that you can outsource and insource the things that really matter. And I think, you know, we're not expert procurement people. We're 90 people. We don't have procurement. We don't have a procurement team, procurement managers. You know, this rests with, you know, for example, our head of technology owns a lot of these contracts. Yep. He's not an expert in procurement management. But guess what? Retease is. And both in terms of the platform, but also their procurement negotiation skills, that was a slam dunk, right? You know, in terms of, can we outsource this and take significant amount of time and energy away from our teams to manage it? It's an absolute no-brainer. So yeah, for me, that was really the decision. Again, like, is there a company that does this expertly? And the answer is yes. And it's been a game changer. I think by now we would have had to have hired a procurement team, to be perfectly honest, without this technology and without their skills. So, and we've saved a lot of money as a result, not just in terms of not needing those resources, but really reviewing the contracts and seeing what we need and what we don't. It's been extremely helpful for us.
Yeah. And I could see that. You know, I've been in companies that had procurement, didn't have procurement, and it's just, it, procurement has always been a challenge, because not only do you have to have the centralized data somewhere, that's number one, and then number two is someone needs to be able to own it and then negotiate it well in advance, and it's like one headache after another.
Yep, exactly right. And you know, I don't know, a credit risk manager doesn't have the, you know, optimum procurement skills. They are great at credit risk management, but, you know, trying to negotiate the costs with, you know, some of these providers is not their skill set, and it shouldn't be. So I think, you know, where you can leverage those kind of those skills, it's super valuable. Just takes the stress away as well.
Yeah. And you know, as you've grown as a company, there were probably some SaaS tools that you use at the beginning. And as you've grown, you've realized that this is just not the right fit anymore. What is your playbook for recognizing when a particular SaaS tool isn't delivering value anymore? And how do you manage that transition away from it?
Yeah, I'd say it's probably not an area that we have a really defined process around. But I think that we're very good as a team at reviewing how things are going. So we do that, you know, annual review of our providers and our contracts, and the team are pretty good at saying, this isn't working for us. Should we review it? And you know, I won't name names, but there have been a couple of examples of that. And we've either then made a decision to change provider, or we've had a conversation with the provider and talked about what we need as a business in order to continue to move forward. And generally, you know, they've been very receptive to that. You know, I think that's where I always prefer to start. It's always less work to have that conversation and see if you can, you know, build a partnership and really solve that together. But it doesn't always happen. And sometimes you have to make the difficult decision to move on. But I think, yeah, that process really around the annual review of the contracts and having that clear accountability, it pops up. You know, somebody brings that to the table. This is not working for these reasons. What do we think? And often that's not around cost. It's often around features, flexibility, service. It's usually those things that take people to the table rather than, hey, these guys have come in with a 20% cost increase. You know, we've seen a lot of that over the last few years. Very, very big increases in contract costs from the SaaS providers, and I think everyone's seen it, right? That's been the nature of the inflationary environment we've been in. But, you know, I think in the tech space, it's sort of been over and above what we've seen elsewhere. So we've really had to manage that.
Yeah, and another thing, which is an interesting conversation I had on this podcast with Adam Smith, which is actually an episode before this one, we've talked about that a lot of the providers are actually adding costs because they're adding AI features, and that does cost more, which obviously, because it costs the providers more, now they have to charge the consumers more as well. So that is one of the reasons why these costs are going so up significantly in the last 2-3 years.
Yeah, which is really exciting. You know, I think, and it's an active conversation in our business, you know, really, how do we leverage AI more, you know, whether that be for basic work around, you know, proposals or job description templates, or, you know, some of the easy things, or some of the more advanced items, you know, as it relates to credit and those types of things. So, yeah, I think it'd be interesting to see how that whole AI piece plays out, particularly with the SaaS providers over the next couple of years. Exciting, I think.
And are you currently using AI in any parts of the business right now?
Not sort of systemically. I think, you know, not in an automated fashion. So we do a lot of, particularly around modeling, where it's that kind of work. But I would say it's not in that automated sense that you see a lot of providers trying to build in. So again, yeah, I think an area of focus. And I think as we, you know, if you think about the journey we're on with automation and operational efficiency, maybe that's phase four. You know, it'd be really interesting to see what's there.
Yeah. This has been a fabulous conversation, Charlene. And my last question for you is, what's your top piece of advice for leaders who are trying to manage the rising SaaS and cloud costs while supporting their growth?
It comes back, honestly, Kathy, to what we said earlier. I think get the information together, get it in one place, and have a look at what do you really need. And if you need to use a third party to help you get to the bottom of that, then you should do so. Don't try and be the expert at the procurement side of things. Go and leverage the experts who can say, you know what, I don't think you need this particular level of customer support. You're not really utilizing it. We can drop you down to the next tier. Or, you know what, if you removed a couple of licenses, you would drop down into the next license tier and save a bucket of money like that. So I think, you know, if you've got that information, it's very, very powerful. And if you use those experts to guide you, you know, for us, that has been super, super helpful. So I would encourage anybody to, particularly in smaller businesses like ours, to leverage those sorts of technology tools and skills that are out there.
Great advice. Thank you so much for this, Charlene. It's absolutely been a pleasure.
Thank you, Kathy. It's been really, really nice talking to you.